Have you been to the Parsha Shadal here before?
Shadal?
Yeah, that's this guy.
Guess not.
Shadal. Okay, fine. So Shadal stands for Shmuel David Luzzatto. Lived in the years 1800 to 1865. Shortish life, you know, 65 years.
Right?
Not that bad. But he lived in Italy all of his life. When he was born, I think it wasn't considered. It was Trieste, apparently Trieste. It wasn't considered part of Italy, but he was part of Italian culture. He taught in a university in Padua, a biblical university, like teaching Tanakh, basically. And that's most of his books are about Tanakh, are commentaries on Tanakh. He has lots of letters. He's a prolific writer. He has tons of periodical entries, like meaning articles that he wrote for like the journals of the time.
About Tanakh.
Mostly about Tanakh and words. He's very interested in that kind of stuff. He also, one of his first books, or really I think it is his first book, was a book on Unculus. Like trying to figure out why Unculus translates the way he does on the Torah. Shadal is a little bit less known than, or a lot less known than, like, you know, Rashi or Ramban. You know, he's not a Rishon, but in certain circles, he's like really well known. So in modern Orthodox circles, like who read Nechama Leibowitz, whatever. He's become more within the mainstream. There was talking about this, like, Shadal was an Italian rabbi. And Italians have a very interesting mode of orthodoxy. You know, out-of-the-box style rabbis who come out of Italy. Europe had a very kind of like, you know, extremes. You had reform and orthodox, and like they were at the extremes of each other. But Italian Jewry never really got into that fray as much. And so you'll have like, you know, think gray areas in Italian Jews. It's interesting. One of my friends started a dissertation, I don't know if he ever finished it, on why he detects in Italian Jewry like a less of an emphasis on halacha and more of an emphasis on philosophy. So he says if you look at the rabbis who come out of Italy, think of a rabbi, they generally have not written halachic svarim. So for example, the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the great grand uncle of Shadal, lived in the 1700s, wrote tremendous philosophy texts, you know, Derech Hashem and Mesilat Yesharim and things like that. But where's this halachic svar, right? And various rabbis who come out of Italy, Ben Mosaic, who else? I'm just like off the top of my head. So like there's a lot of Kabbalists who come out of Italy as well. And like the only person that people can really point to and say, oh, an Italian rabbi who wrote on halacha is a Tosafist. Like that's basically it, right? Yeah, right. I guess so, right? The family.
Who was also a doctor?
But we're talking like 1200s, 1300s, right? Yeah, I'm saying so. Like from that span to now, to the 1800s, there really were not like many halachic svarim coming out of Italy, and so he wrote this dissertation, or started at least in the research, to like try to figure out what is it in the water of Italy that's like making them. Is it that the proximity to Rome and the Vatican that might have something to do with that, and maybe the halacha wasn't as important as the hashkafa, maybe to fight against Christianity and to show how important we like are or how wise we are. But it happens to be like he's a controversial figure. In more right-wing circles, they wouldn't think of Shadal. There's a couple reasons for that. So there's a couple reasons for that. Number one is that in his opinion, halacha was decided by the rabbis over time. So interpretations of the Torah, the oraisas, are not interpretations that go back to Sinai, but rather dependent on the time in which Chazal lived. We have to keep the halacha, he thinks, because we're rabbinic Jews and we require a new Sanhedrin in order to revamp the halacha. But Shadal was of the opinion that this came from the development of halacha. So, for example, I'll give an example. Which year are you? Rabbi Zeringshir? Right? So you did, I think I even learned this a little bit with you. Maybe I was helping you out. When it comes to a person eating the Karan Pesach who is a Ben Nechar, do you learn about that? A Ben Nechar can't eat of the Karan Pesach. That's what it says in the Pasuk. Literally, it means the son of a foreigner. But Chazal, Rashi quotes it there, and Chazal understand, Ben Nechar is someone who apostatizes, who becomes a non-religious Jew, or rather converts to another religion, whatever it is, who, an apostate Jew. That's how Chazal understand it. Uncle Asifin translates it there as someone who becomes Kitnacher, he becomes foreign to himself, like he becomes foreign to his Judaism.
The literal understanding?
The son of a foreigner, or the category of a foreigner. Like someone who's not part of the Jewish people. You would normally translate that pasuk to mean that non-Jew can't eat of the Karban Pesach. Only Jews can eat of the Karban Pesach. But we're reading this as Kal v'chomer a non-Jew. But even more than that, a Jew. A Jew who is not religious, who acts as a non-Jew.
Right. So he would say, should always say so that is not
he doesn't,
necessarily much
yeah, exactly. He thinks that interpretation was because Chazal were looking at their society and we're seeing a lot of apostasy. People were going off the derech. And they said, you know what? If you go off the derech, you can't eat of the Karban Pesach. And they felt like it was a good guard to prevent people from going off the derech.
Okay.
That's pretty controversial, that view of halacha. But he believes it's binding. Now, I say that even though there's a letter that people have pointed to that said that Shadal wrote tons of letters. So we have a letter of his where he talks about the isser of shaving. Not allowed to shave with a straight razor, right? Can't shave the beard. And in the context of the Torah, where it's coming from, it says you can't do it as part of a ritual of mourning. Right? That if someone's dead and you want to shave you want to put gashes in your face, use a straight razor to shave off your face as a sign of mourning, you can't do that. That's the shot in the Torah. According to Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam, you can look over there. Right? So Shadal is discussing this in the letter, and he says, I'm not opposed to it. I don't write on halacha. But for myself, I hold like the Ibn Ezra. Does that mean that he shaves with a straight razor?
Meaning,
like the Ibn Ezra and others say, that the pshat in the pasuk is not about a regular person, you and me, shaving our faces, but in a very specific ritual context having to do with grief and mourning. So if you're not in grief and mourning, presumably it would be permissible. And Shadal says, for myself, I hold that way. Now that's completely against the Rishonim, like the halachic Rishonim. Like
not Ibn Ezra's before the Rishonim?
No, Ibn Ezra's a Rishon, but he is not saying that as the halachic. He's saying that's pshat in the Torah. He's saying that's not, right? There's a distinction between what's pshat in the Torah and what's the actual, how's the halachic go. So Shadal says, oh, for me, I accept the pshat as the halacha, which you're not allowed to do, right? You can't say ayin tachat ayin. It says eye for an eye. And you say, well, I paskin that I think that you should actually take out someone's eye if he, No, you have to hold like Chazal. Chazal say refers to the money. Now, Shadal, on that, I'm saying that, it just gets even more complicated because eye for an eye is an interesting example. Because Shadal says the reason why it's phrased as eye for an eye, even though it means money, is to leave the option for Chazal or for the Sanhedrin to actually put out someone's eye if he deserves it. Like, to give that option in the we're not going against the Torah, we actually put out someone's eye.
So that is a very interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, but focusing on his willingness.
Like the Torah is designed to be interpreted by the...
Yes. Rabbi. Which is, it can be controversial because, like, you're giving a lot of power to the rabbis, and you can imagine someone saying, well, these rabbis are stupid. I think that the halacha should be X, Y, and Z. Why should I hold like that?
It makes it seem very subjective.
Right, exactly. And people, especially if Shadal locates the halacha in the time period in which Chazal lived, which is not relevant to us today, right? So some people have called Shadal a proto-conservative or proto-reform. It was before those concepts existed. It was before there was a change. But he was like just on the cusp of that and had those kind of ideas. But he still believed that halakha was binding, except for this one about shaving.
So what do you think his reaction would be to like modern conservatism?
He might, who knows? Maybe he would have been more of a conservative Jew than an Orthodox Jew. I don't know. It's hard to say. Now, Dan Klein, in his Vayikra volume, in the introduction, tries to defend Shadal. I think it's a little bit of a stretch. And tries to defend Shadal and say, when he said that he would shave with a straight razor, what he meant was, no, he holds by some of the more controversial, not an actual straight razor, but some of the more controversial shaving methods that were available at the time, such as creams that would make your like hair fall out, depilatory creams. So there was some controversy in the halacha whether you can actually use those. So Shaddal was saying that he was willing to use even those, but he would not have gone far enough to shave his face. You have to look at the context there, but I have other theories that I think are... I think that was a little bit of a stretch, because he just doesn't name those things and he doesn't talk about them. Also, it's not really so controversial to use depilatory creams. It's like you'll find like one in a million rabbis who may be against that. Anyway, that's what makes him a little bit of a controversial figure. He also quotes Roman authority. He quotes tons of classical literature to support his point about the Torah. He was also using like other languages to compare to the Torah. It's a very academic kind of approach. So in that context, I guess we'll do a little bit on Noach, even though I said it was going to be 5 minutes. You know, definitely
it
wasn't.
There was a lot of context.
Yeah. Well, you said who's Shaddal. I got to tell you.
I know who Shaddal is.
I'll just
he's
add one.
Guy.
I know. He's an interesting guy. I think he's fascinating. His commentary is fascinating. I'll just add one more thing to end this conversation. Mark Shapiro, Dr. Mark Shapiro, wrote a book.
He's a professor
in Scranton University. I know,
okay,
right?
Okay, Mark Shapiro.
No. But he's an interesting guy. He's a lot, like a lot today. He writes on modern Orthodoxy, on biographies of rabbis, and he wrote a somewhat famous book in the early 2000s called The Limits of Orthodox Theology. The 13 Principles Reappraised. The Maimonides' 13 Principles Reappraised. And this book was based off of an article he wrote in the Torah Umada Journal. It was published by NYU. The Torah Umada Journal, someone had written that the standard for orthodoxy, what is considered the box of orthodoxy, if you're within it, you can call yourself orthodox, is if you believe in the Rambam's 13 Principles of Faith. And he said in this article that nobody has ever disagreed with those. No Orthodox rabbi has ever disagreed with those 13 principles of faith. So Mark Shapiro is like wrote an article. It's like 70 pages long. In this, as a response to that statement, saying, "Well, I can show you tons of rabbis who've quibbled or disagreed outright with certain parts of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith." There are rabbis, like, for example, in terms of, like, you won't find, like, the first of the principles of faith is that God exists, right? Right? So you won't have, like, someone who disagrees on that. But there are those who believe, let's say, that God didn't create the world, but formed it out of pre-matter. Or you will have some... who said like for the eighth principle of faith is that the Torah that we have today is exactly the same one as was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. And there are rabbis who said, well, not exactly, like there are differences, it's not exactly the same, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. You have various, you know, nuances.
Was he writing this again?
A rabbi in the Torah Umada Journal, I want to say Yehuda Parnas, but I don't remember exactly. And what? So he wrote this 70-page article, and then he turned it into a book that ended up being like 300 pages, right, as it is. And so he included, he said in his instruction, I only want to include rabbis who everybody agrees are like on the level, are like not controversial, not minority figures, people who had were standard Orthodox bearers of tradition. I'm not going to include the random rabbi who like is obviously crazy, you know, there's lots of rabbis like that throughout Jewish history. So he included Shaddal. And then he said later that he regretted having included Shaddal because obviously he wasn't Orthodox. He's more pre-conservative or proto-conservative. So Dan Klein is like really upset about this. He's like, just one letter that's a little ambiguous and you could give a different interpretation on it and you're going to cast Shaddal into like outside of Orthodoxy. He felt it was inappropriate. Okay, so one example of what Shaddal does in his commentary is he deals with issues of documentary hypothesis. Now, the documentary hypothesis, as we know today, the idea that God didn't write the Torah, or rather, maybe it's better put, that the Torah is a composite of various documents, whether God wrote them or not, that actually came after Shaddal's lifetime. But there were people who were thinking of this, these kind of ideas before Wellhausen, before the like famous documentary hypothesis was put forward. And so in the, early on in Parshat Noach, Shadal wants to deal with that as it applies to Parshat Noach. Why? Because there's multiple stories. There's interlocking, repetitive stories of Noach and the flood. There's lots of different answers that you can give for why there's this repetition. Like, there's multiple times that it describes Noach going into the ark. There's multiple times that there's God commands him to collect.
I kind of forgot how it's laid out. So
what?
It just repeats.
You go through the story. Okay, God says, how many animals should Noach take onto the ark? You know, how many animals?
The first time
I want to say 7 by 7, and the second time it's 2 by 2. But it might be switched around. And there's like various things are like, wait, hold on. Didn't you command them and it should be 7 by 7? Now it's 2 by 2. What's going on here?
Right.
There's multiple times they enters the teva. Like it says that he goes in. A few psukim go by talking about the rain coming down, and then again it says that he went in to the teva. Like what happened? Right? And so there's various times. And also God's name changes, right? Yukei Vavke versus Elohim. So there are various answers that people give. Rabbi Mordechai Breuer was a famous approach that kind of like took documentary hypothesis questions and said, well, no, the Torah is intentionally, it's not that there's different documents. The Torah is intentionally written to include different perspectives and intertwine them for lessons, for the purposes of our interpretation. So Shadal has a different kind of answer, or he thinks that the entire approach is wrongheaded in the first place. As you can see from here, most of this is in Italian. Not Italian, actually. I think it might be Latin. So I'm going to read it from, if you don't mind, from the English translation, where he did the work for us, and so I'll just read you this comment. I think it's very fascinating. All the way in the beginning, again, this is like, you know, the defending orthodoxy, right? So it says, this is the first pasuk in Noah, right? This is how Shadal translates it, by the way. He translated into Italian, Dan Klein translated into English, so okay, you're getting three ways removed from the actual words of the Torah, but this is a story of Noah, right? Toldot Noah. What? This is not, he wrote a separate book on Onkelos called Oedgeh. Yeah. This is the story of Noah. Noah was a just and upright man among his contemporaries. Noah walked with God. Okay. He says, among his contemporaries. He alone was just in those generations that God sent him, for it is you I see righteous before me in this generation. Meaning, he doesn't think that Bedoratav, among his, in his generation, is to indicate, like, in a different generation he would have been worse, or he would have been better, like Rashi gets into that, right? Well, why is it saying in his generation? Is that to indicate if he was in Avram's generation, he'd be even better, or does that indicate that if he was Avram's generation, he'd be much worse? So Shadal thinks it's not what you're mistranslating. It means Bitoratav means in his generation, means among the people of his generation, among his contemporaries, the people who existed then, right? Right? So that's how he understands it. And apparently that's what the Ramban says as well. Okay, throughout, this is the emphasis. Here we go. Throughout the entire story of Noah, we see the divine names Elohim and Yukevavke juxtaposed in such a way as to refute decisively the opinion that Moses found several ancient scrolls with the sections containing the name Elohim written in one generation by certain men, sections containing the Tetragrammaton, meaning Yukevavke, written in another generation by other men. Okay, he says, the fact that throughout the story you'll notice that Yukevavke and Elohim are constantly intertwined and being used in various psukim in different ways shows that it can't be that there's like separate scrolls that Moshe Rabbeinu put together. Like that's some people believe. Modern critics have exerted themselves in such investigations, but their efforts have been in vain. He thinks that it's so obvious. The fact that it's intertwined means that it can't possibly be that these are separate scrolls. Now, what's the response that you can say? You say, well, maybe Moshe intertwined them. Maybe he spliced them together, right? But why would somebody do that, right? The first of them was Ashtruck in 1753, who wrote Conjectures sur les Memoires Originales, I don't know, whatever. Conjectures on the original records, which Moses apparently made use of in composing the Book of Genesis. 1753. There's already a documentary about this, about Moshe Rabbeinu. That Moshe Rabbeinu put them together. That he put these together. In his opinion, Moshe made use of 12 ancient scrolls. He was followed by Eichhorn, who also said this, that Moses made use of only two scrolls. They interpolated a few words here and there. Right? He spliced them together. He was followed by Ilgin, who also said, okay, that the book of Genesis was compiled from three books. That was 1798. Okay. I thought it fitting to cite the words of Rosenmuller here, for they are pleasing. Ask me who Rosenmuller is. I don't exactly remember. I can go to the back. He has a nice little thing here. An Italian rabbi, I believe. Here's what he says. He lived 1768 to 1835. He was a German Orientalist theologian and exegete. Included exegetical notes by Chagall in French on Isaiah, as an introduction to his own Isaiah commentary. Rosenmuller was Scholia in Pentateuchum, was relied upon heavily by Chagall as a source of information and commentary. Rosenmuller was a big source for Chagall. He was really into this guy, a German scholar on the Bible. Okay, this is what he says, and with this we'll end, right, this paragraph. If in any other, then most of all in this clear passage may be detected, so established the more recent post-Ashuric scholars, signs of two records out of which this passage might have been joined together, that the alternating gods, names of God, Yukevavke, and Elohim, and certain formulas of speech that are said to be peculiar to one or the others of those two records. You can look at the story of Noah and detect like two strata. It looks like there's two layers. It's very easy to find that. No, if you look at it closely, you'll see that. It says, but when, following these uncertain leaders, such scholars exert themselves to discern these records, they disagree exceedingly among themselves. What's funny is that if you try to pick out what are the layers, you'll find like 20 people will have 20 different opinions about where the layers stop and start. Often, that is, that which one of them assigns to a record in which the name Elohim is used, another one will ascribe to the one, right? This is a classic critique of documentary hypothesis, that some people say, oh, that, you know, they have their classic is that there's four authors. Yukevavke, the person who would call God Yukevavke, the person who calls God Elohim, the Levitical priests, right? And the Deuteronomist. Did I miss any? The redactor.
J is the Jew.
Isn't that Yukevavke? Yeah, I got that. Yeah. The Elohist, right? E, J, P, I think, is the priestly people. And the Deuteronomists. The guys who were working in the Beit HaMikdash who might have wanted to write their own version of the Torah. Like, this is what the documentary about these people said. So he says, this is a classic critique that also applies today. Whenever you look at these books on documentary hypothesis, none of them can agree if this particular pasuk that might not necessarily have God's name in it, is that one a priestly document layer? Is that a Deuteronomist interpolation? You know, and you can make up anything you want because it's impossible to tell, and you can come up with your own theories either way. There is, furthermore, another thing that makes that conjecture subject to suspicion. That is, the writer of Genesis either would have had to join those complete records together alternatingly, meaning you would have had to do like a Yukevavke pasuk and then an Elohim pasuk.
Switching it out pasuk by pasuk.
What?
Switching it out pasuk by pasuk.
Why would you do that, right? If this is your assumption, then it would be astonishing why the writer did not omit repetitions. If he's being very careful and like in putting both manuscripts together, why would he maintain all the mistakes, like all of the same details over and over again? It would be surely the presumed original narrative would have appeared separately in one or the other record in a defective and gaping form. If the reason why he's putting them together is because he's trying to fill in information from the other, then only fill in the information that's missing.
Yeah, he would have had to have been very lazy.
So either lazy, I guess the other response is maybe he wanted to maintain the sanctity of both and not lose anything from both because maybe he wasn't sure which one is the correct one. I don't know. He says, Kopin in this other work has also said this. We have no doubt that the author, this is Cyril Rosenmuller, within the ambit of the same few words, would have avoided the repetition of the name, sometimes using Elikim, other times using Yud Kei Vav Kei, in the style of any other book of the Old Testament. Like, this is where it's really interspersed. It's clear that if you were a good editor, you would have been more careful about this. The fact that he is not more careful indicates to Elie Shadal and Rosenmuller that these are not separate books, but are intentionally written the way that they are written. Shadal doesn't get into why are they repetitive, at least not here. Why are they repetitive? Why is there the differences of the names? He doesn't get into that, at least in this paragraph. Maybe he does later, but it's all to defend the sanctity and the unity of the biblical text.